they're picking a fight that makes no sense to pick, and it's going to be a big distraction, and for what purpose?
A debate about who has authority to allow seismic testing in Anwar. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, September 18th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, as new tug operators prepare to take over escorting oil tankers from Valdez, a watchdog group calls for more training.
I don't feel personally it's too much to ask. If you're going to make your money in it, then you need to prove that you can prevent it.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The 10 federal subsistence regional advisory councils are conducting meetings from late September through November to discuss proposals for federal subsistence wildlife and trapping regulations and other issues. Public participation is encouraged. Information at doi.gov/subsistence/regions or call 800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
The Washington Post last week reported on Interior Department memos that show the Trump administration is trying to let industry into the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to do seismic exploration on the coastal plain. The prospect has environmentalists crying foul. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin looks at whether it's legal.
When Congress was redrawing the map of Alaska's federal lands in 1980, it couldn't decide whether the flat part along the coast of the Arctic Refuge should be wilderness or oil field. So it said it would decide later. That was in the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act. Congress also called for a report on what oil might be there, with seismic work to inform that report. So that was done. Congress got its report in 1987. And for 30 years, the Interior Department has maintained any more seismic work, or drilling, would require an act of Congress. David Hayes was a Deputy Interior Secretary in the Clinton and Obama administrations. He says a formal opinion on the subject by the Interior Solicitor in 2001 was crystal clear.
It was quite definitive that the window was closed.
But then in 2013, the state of Alaska claimed that the window was still open because if you take a close look at ANILCA, the law does not provide a date saying when authority for seismic work would expire. U.S. District Court Judge Sharon Gleason decided for the Obama administration in 2015. She said when you look at the context of the law, it was reasonable to read ANILCA as saying the authority for seismic work was a one-time deal and the window closed in 1987. The judge did not say that was the only reasonable interpretation. And we may find out if other interpretations can pass judicial muster too, because there's been a sea change of management at Interior. The attorney who argued the state's case, David Bernhardt, is the new Deputy Secretary of the Interior. Now the department is moving to rewrite its rules to allow more seismic exploration on the coastal plain. Hayes, the former deputy, says this is folly.
They're picking a fight that makes no sense to pick, and it's going to be a big distraction. And for what purpose?
With oil prices low, Hayes says no oil company is going to want to go to the expense.
You don't know that until you put it out to lease and or put it out for opportunity to shoot the seismic.
Alaska Oil and Gas President Kara Moriarty says the argument that oil companies aren't interested is a red herring. She says it would be good to get equipment back in to shoot seismic waves into the coastal plain because technology is so much better than it was in the 80s.
Why do we not want to know what's there? Why wouldn't Americans want to know what your resources are in a more concrete way?
According to an August 11 memo, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has been ordered to begin work on an environmental assessment, as well as new regulations that extend the date for seismic work. One person who will be following it closely is attorney Brooke Brisson at Trustees for Alaska, an environmental law firm. For more than 30 years, the Interior Department has said only Congress can allow more seismic exploration on the coastal plain, and Brisson says the department had it right in the first place. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Next year, brand new tugboats and barges will arrive in Prince William Sound with a big responsibility: to prevent another oil spill like the Exxon Valdez in 1989. But vessels aren't the only new element arriving next year. At a meeting held last week, the official Citizens Watchdog Group for the Sound raised concerns about how new crews manning the vessels will be trained. Elizabeth Harbaugh with Alaska's Energy Desk has an update.
Louisiana-based Edison Schuest Offshore will soon replace Crowley Marine Services as the contractor providing the tugboats, equipment, and people, ensuring oil tankers move through Prince William Sound safely. Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, which operates the Trans-Alaska Pipeline and opted to make the switch to Edison Schuest last year, has already faced pointed questions. Those questions came from state regulators and the Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council, a watchdog group. Earlier this year, the council commissioned a report that raised concerns about the vessel's design. At the Whittier meeting, council members who visited Louisiana to see the new tugs being built said they were impressed. This is Jim Herbert, who sits on the Oil Spill Prevention and Response Committee.
I'm not putting on my Edison Schuest hat now, but I do believe these are going to be some good boats.
But Brooke Taylor, a spokeswoman for the council, says they're still waiting on more testing and modeling to see if all their concerns can be put to rest. Beyond how the tugboats are built, Taylor says a big focus going forward will be making sure new crews are properly trained.
That questionable factor is always going to be people. If they're not properly trained, if they're not accustomed to a new environment, then you're going to have a weak link in the system, and that's where most accidents are going to be triggered from.
But what does proper training look like? Last week, the board discussed a report it commissioned concluding that new crews and equipment should be put to the test in 90th percentile conditions. In Prince William Sound, that means 22-knot winds and or 12-foot seas. The council hasn't officially decided to back the report's conclusions, but in 2003, it took the position that if it's unsafe to train in stormy weather conditions, Alyeska shouldn't operate in those conditions. During last week's meeting, Councilmember Amanda Bauer said she stands by that position.
I don't feel personally it's too much to ask. If you're going to make your money in it, then you need to prove that you can prevent it.
But Alyeska isn't on board with the idea. Mike Day, who is managing the transition for Alyeska, says training in more extreme conditions outlined in the report isn't a good idea because it could put crews at risk.
We believe that it's not critical or necessary to train in storms in order to be prepared to operate in storms.
New tugboats are expected to arrive in Prince William Sound in early 2018. Training for the new crews is expected to begin as early as next month. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
If the state budget hadn't lowered Alaska Permanent Fund dividends this year, they would have been among the highest in state history at more than $2,300. Instead, they will be $1,100. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports on the change.
The day that Permanent Fund dividends were announced used to be a celebration.
This is the first time I'm going to see this amount with Alaskans. So Alaskans' 2014 dividend amount is $1,884.
That was Governor Sean Parnell in 2014. In 2015, Governor Bill Walker had a grave tone as Palmer student Shania Summer announced a PFD of more than $2,000.
Some may see this dollar amount, which Shania will announce, and go, well, everything is fine. Well, it's not. We have some challenges as a result of the price of oil.
This year was different again. The announcement came in a Friday afternoon press release. Permanent Fund Dividend Division officials say they didn't calculate what PFDs would have been since it wasn't necessary. Last year, the dividend wasn't certain until the announcement because it depended on the number of applicants who were eligible. This year, the legislature set the amount. Anchorage resident Andre McLeod reached out to state officials, lawmakers, and reporters asking why the amount set by the original state law wasn't made public.
Why has this administration not gone through the process to actually inform and notice Alaskans what that exact amount of the dividend would have been had the legislature not dickered around with our permanent fund dividend amounts.
The amount of permanent fund earnings available for PFDs under the state law that created dividends was more than $1.5 billion. The state expects about 640,000 Alaskans to receive dividends. Putting current state data through the original formula, PFDs would have been about $2,350 each. That would have been the highest dollar figure in dividend history without adjusting for inflation. With inflation, it would have been the fifth highest. Anchorage Democratic Representative Andy Josephson says he understands why the administration didn't announce the number.
So there was no hiding of the number. It was talked about all the time. So I'm not quite sure what the complaint is. I understand why the Department of Revenue might not want to run a set of numbers that are sort of moot at this point.
Josephson says the House majority he's a member of didn't want to reduce PFDs without adding new revenue. But he says a deal over dividends was necessary to avoid a state government shutdown.
But we were left with the following situation. Does the government shut down because the two sides are at loggerheads on the 1st of July? Or do we try to at least secure adequate public services for the people?
The legislature drew from another savings account, the Constitutional Budget Reserve, in order to cover the gap between how much the state government spends and how much it brings in taxes, fees, and oil royalties. Governor Bill Walker says he'll call lawmakers back on October 23rd to Juneau for a fourth special session focused on revenue. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, medical supply shortages create anxiety and extra expense.
We've had, I believe, in upwards of about 10 different medications this year that have had some kind of delay or availability issue.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
Recent warm, dry weather in the interior has resulted in two late-season wildfires. State Forestry reports sending firefighters last night to a one-acre blaze located about 100 miles northeast of Glen Allen near Shoshana. It says the fire, burning in Wrangell-St. Elias National Park and Preserve, was observed to be creeping and smoldering with light rain falling on it last night. Forestry says the fire is not accessible by road, and weather prevented firefighters from getting to it last night. The other new fire was reported last week by a boater along the Tanana River on a native land allotment about 15 miles downstream from Nenana. The Alaska Fire Service says two firefighters went to the site Friday to work on the fire, which was estimated at less than an acre, with activity again described as smoldering and creeping. Both fires are suspected to be human-caused. State and federal agencies say Alaska has minimal staff on hand to fight fires in Alaska right now, as most are deployed to battle major blazes in the western lower 48. The AFS says nearly 653,000 acres have burned in Alaska so far this year, well below the normal average of 1 to 2 million acres. Emergency medics in Anchorage are scrambling to cope with a shortage of critical medications. It's a problem with the drug supply across the country that's been happening for several years. But as Alaska Public Media's Zechariah Hughes reports, first responders and hospitals are spending more resources just trying to keep up.
If you ask Assistant Chief Eric Schuneman which medications are in short supply for the fire department's ambulance crews, at the top of the list is a common drug called epinephrine that comes in preloaded syringes.
It's used in all of our cardiac arrest resuscitations and as our primary drug for anaphylaxis, which is a severe allergic reaction.
But it's been on back order for almost 5 months, Schuneman says, with no word on when more will be in stock. As a workaround, medics take the same medication at a higher concentration from a vial and dilute it before administering, which takes 15 to 20 seconds longer. That's not a huge delay, but in a crisis, those slivers of time can make a difference. Schuneman calls the shortage the new normal for emergency medical services, a nearly decade-long national problem experienced across the healthcare system. A report last year from the Government Accountability Office cites potential causes of the shortages. Those include low profitability in the market for some older generic medications, supply line problems, and increased inspection standards by the Food and Drug Administration. And Schuneman says these kinds of shortages are happening with some of the department's most vital tools for emergency medicine.
We've had, I believe, an upwards of about 10 different medications this year that have had some kind of delay or availability issue. Compared to 2016, it just seems to be more prevalent.
AFD has different strategies to cope with supply problems. Sometimes, like with epinephrine, they'll carry an alternative medication that's similar. Otherwise, if a drug is scarce, medics will carry a limited amount and drive back to a central location to restock after using it on a patient. The protocol helps managers stay on top of tight inventories. Tracking the fluctuating supplies and keeping staff appropriately trained, Schuneman says, has downstream effects on the department's resources.
It does take an inordinate amount of extra staff hours to try to mitigate the situation when it comes up.
Schuneman didn't have an estimate for all the man hours spent on extra trips to restock, training staff and new procedures, and tracking the logistics of drugs getting scarce, running out, or coming back in stock. It's not just fire departments that are seeing the constriction. Andre Neptune has worked at Providence Hospital for 3 decades and spent the last 10 years as the director of pharmaceutical care services.
It does appear to me the frequency of shortages and sometimes even the severity of them seems to be getting worse.
Neptune says the list for medications that are getting hard to keep stocked is broad-based and includes everything from antibiotics to anesthetic agents, as well as pain medications and drugs for chemotherapy. He estimates that for the team managing the hospital's pharmacy inventory, about a quarter of their time is just spent managing supply levels.
When I started my career 30 years ago, shortages were not a daily conversation. It was a rare or an occasional conversation, and today it's a daily conversation.
There have been some short-term solutions in the last few months, like the FDA extending expiration dates on batches of some medications so they can stay on the shelves a few months longer, but no major structural reforms appear to be on the horizon. The GAO report notes that such shortages can affect a healthcare provider's ability to safely and effectively care for patients. Schuneman, with the fire department, says no one in AFD's care has been hurt as a result of a short drug supply, but that workarounds and alternatives to best practices create more of an opportunity for error. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
The Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission is seeking a significant increase in the number of bowhead whales that can be harvested annually by subsistence hunters from 11 villages. Commission Chairman John Hobson Jr. says in a statement to federal officials reviewing the catch limits that the commission wants yearly strike limits raised to 100 from the current 67 strikes. Hobson says the current limit was set in 1997, when the bowhead population was half of today's estimate. The public comment period closed last week as part of a National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration review on catch limits for the Alaska Native communities for a 6-year period to begin in 2019. The International Whaling Commission, which meets next year in Brazil, has final say on quotas for subsistence harvesting of whales.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers the Alaska Supplemental Education Loan for students attending most college or training programs in or outside of Alaska, and it offers interest rates lower than the Federal Plus. For more information, call 800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, Alaska's higher education state agency.
Staying calm and taking responsibility are some of the keys to success, both inside and outside of prison. But sometimes it takes more than a person to teach that. Meet the dogs of Wildwood Correctional Center. Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman has more from the Solutions Desk.
Taz, can you sit down? You want a treat? Can you sit? Can you give me a paw?
Ernie Rogers, who's serving time at Wildwood Correctional Center, and his dog, Taz, match. They're both large and bulky and calm. Roger says this was always true of Taz, who's half Great Pyrenees and half Mastiff.
He's never barked. He's never growled. He's the calmest dog you'll ever meet.
But this was not the case for Rogers, who experiences some mental health challenges. He and staff say having Taz around for the past 7 months has made Rogers more patient, calm, and responsible. He says he's even kept his cool at the most trying times, like when the dog accidentally broke the television he saved up for 6 months to buy. It was frustrating, but he knew 114-pound Taz didn't mean it, so he learned to forgive. Roger says the new friendship is helping counteract the effects of his negative childhood.
I came from an abusive household, so, you know, it's hard to explain. I was bullied as a kid. I was a loner. So this is like the only friend I had that was loyal to me. So it's, you know, it gives me a lot of attention, so I kind of like it. So it's pretty cool.
The Special Pet Obedience and Training Program started at Wildwood in 2013 and was modeled after one at Highland Mountain Correctional Center in Eagle River. A similar program recently started at Spring Creek and Seward, and nearly 300 exist nationwide. The dogs are rescue animals, and inmates pay for the animals' food and medical care themselves by selling things like food and personal items to other inmates through internal organizations. Most research on dog training programs in prisons, including a large analysis published in the Prison Journal, shows they have positive impacts on inmate behavior and help them increase their self-control. That's the effect dog training had on Jonathan Norton, who learned to work with the animals when he was an inmate in an Arizona prison years ago, and is now one of the main trainers at Wildwood. For example, one time...
Me and another guy, we were having words with each other, and it was going to go violent. But I had my dog, and I was just about to pass my leash to a friend of mine to take my dog away. But then I got to thinking, okay, this dog depends on me. I've been this dog's owner for the past, you know, 2 or 3 months, and I'm the one that this dog knows. So how am I going to abandon the dog? I guess that's how I felt.
Norton says he calmed down and settled the dispute with the other guy without fighting. He says now he uses the ideas he learned for training dogs when working with other people.
If I come with a positive approach, regardless of how the person's coming at me, then it's very less likely that anything negative is going to happen.
Wildwood Superintendent Shannon McLeod started the program because she wanted to keep people busy, and she loves dogs. She says having them around makes everyone happy, including the staff. And she's seen how the dogs can completely transform inmates, which improves the overall environment in the prison.
I mean, they're so respectful, they don't want to lose the dog. They're very good with staff, very tuned into the dog, and making sure that the dog is, they know the life the dog probably has had wasn't good, and so they want to make their life better.
Research supports McLeod's observations, too. Though studies on the programs have limits because of their small sample sizes and few control groups, they found that dog training in prisons reduces recidivism and improves the behavior of long-term prisoners. Ernie Rogers says there are some drawbacks to sharing his tiny cell and single bed with his giant friend.
Dog hair all over the place, stuff like that. It's not as big a perk as you would think.
But Rogers says he understands how to treat people now, and he'll be different if he's released. And he learned it all from his dog.
Good boy. Good boy.
From the Solutions Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
If you want to hear more ideas that can lead to community change, subscribe to the Solutions Desk podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or NPR One, or visit alaskapublic.org/solutions. This summer, a couple returned to the city of Kodiak after roughly 10 years of sailing the world. Mike Litzo and Elisa Obakayer raised 2 sons while living a seafaring nomadic lifestyle. Now the family plans to call Kodiak home for the foreseeable future. KMXT's Kayla DeRoche stopped by their houseboat on Near Island.
We went to spent a year in Patagonia. And went to the Falkland Islands.
Alyssa traces her family's journey on a plastic globe. Behind her, 7-year-old Eric and 11-year-old Elias fuel up on fruit. They're getting ready for an afternoon cross-country race. Elias is trying his hand at track and field. Alyssa says it's the first time the boys have joined team sports. They've spent most of their lives at sea. Alyssa and Mike lived in Kodiak for 7 years and set off for their world travels when Elias was under a year old. On the globe, Alyssa points out Australia, where Eric was born.
Well, we kind of combined two dreams. You know, Mike wanted to sail to Australia, and I wanted to be a full-time mom. So we did it at the same time.
They lived in Australia for a couple of years, and another year in Chile, and otherwise traveled where they wanted. Mike made a living remotely working on fisheries data analysis, and Alyssa homeschooled their sons, who otherwise entertained themselves with everything from bird watching to drawing. Eric climbs onto a counter in their kitchen and points out a couple of his creations.
I'm getting a bit too big to show you. This one and this one are my ones.
What are they of?
This one's two knights fighting, this one's a bird.
Elias holds up what looks like a self-made reference chart covered in colorful fish lures and other objects.
It's like what I'd actually want to buy if I had a bunch of money, but it would cost so much money.
Elias talks about some of the other activities he did to pass the time on the boat, like snorkeling and sailing.
But fishing's sort of my favorite all the time.
He says his family caught squid, mahi-mahi, and wahoo during their travels. Alyssa says they had a fridge on board, but not a freezer, which means the fish didn't stay good very long unless they canned or consumed it.
When we catch a fish, we stop fishing, and then we eat fish for breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
The family arrived in Kodiak in July. Alyssa says they're settling in.
Sometimes it feels like we're still visiting, but for the most part, it's wonderful. We're really glad to be back in Kodiak.
Or if we have a house, because like we're going to have a house pretty soon.
Someday we will.
Mike says it's the right time for a more permanent home.
Our kids are getting to the point where they'll be happy to be in school and have some friends outside the family and have some friends who they know for more than a month at a time. You know, we've been leading this very peripatetic life where they didn't have any really stable friendships. I guess my wife and I love Alaska.
Mike has returned to the science scene in Kodiak. He now works as an assistant research professor at the Kodiak Seafood and Marine Science Center on Near Island. In Kodiak, I'm Kayla DeRoche.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Elizabeth Harbaugh, Ann Hillman, and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by BP, production in Prudhoe Bay began 40 years ago. Today, as a result of continued investment, BP is producing 55% of Alaska's oil. Learn more about BP's investments in Alaska for today and tomorrow at bp.com/Alaska.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft in airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.